Welcome, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. Today, I'm joined by Jeff Conrad, who offline we found out his weather and my weather is very similar today. A couple days ago, Walla Walla, which is where I'm at right now, peaked out at 116 degrees. That was our highest ever recorded temperature. I know there was a couple towns in our area that were 118. And I think a town in British Columbia, close to Vancouver, just east of Vancouver, hit 121 on either Monday or Tuesday. And that's the all-time record for Canada. But Jeff Conrad is with, I'm going to say, you know, I forgot to ask you, Jeff, is it Agus Capital? Is that how you pronounce it?
Oh, yes, it's Agus Capital and actually stands for Agricultural Investment Strategies. So okay. It's Agus.
Okay. Well, Jeff, thank you for joining. You know, as become apparent as we're talking, you really have a little bit of a farm background, but your career has really been spent more on the investment banking side than it's been spent actually being an owner directly and farming the dirt and so on. But why don't you just start off with your background, where you grew up, how you got involved in ag and so on, and we'll go from there.
Yes. Well, first of all, Paul, thanks for the opportunity to be on your podcast. I always tell people, you know, I'm just an old dairy farm kid because I actually grew up in central Pennsylvania on a dairy crop farm. And for those people that might know the area, you're aware that they tend to be smaller farms, and we had 40 dairy cows and the crops. So I spent time doing that. I would say, unlike most farm kids, it seems like a lot of them are very eager to get back to the farm. I grew up and I was very eager to get off to college. And yep. So I ended up at Penn State and eventually Cornell, always working in agriculture. So, you know, I like to say we're in the investment management business, that we buy farms, agricultural properties for our clients. But I still view myself as being in agriculture, but very much removed from the dirt day to day. And that's still, you know, capital market side of the business.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. My career is probably, you know, similar to yours in that, you know, I grew up on a wheat farm. I probably had a passion for going back to the farm. My brother was allergic to wheat dust, so he was never going to be interested in farming. And my sister wasn't interested, but you know, I was graduating from college in the early 80s. You know, my dad was older; he was you know, early 70s at that point in time, and he and I were sort of penciling it out. And they owned about 500 acres, and with farming another 500 or so. And it just, you know, in the early 80s, you know, trying to pencil that out, it was like that doesn't look too good. And then my dad, he had an eighth grade education, grew up in the Dakotas, and the fact that I was going to become a CPA, he thought that was, hey, that's wonderful. Go out and be a CPA. And if you want to go back to a farm at some point in time, that's fine. And now I've sort of come almost full circle. You know, last year I ended up buying two farms, one near my home in Washington State, one in Iowa. And I'm getting ready to close on a 360-acre little farm down in southwest Missouri. So I'm diversifying my risk, so to speak. So now the one thing I noticed, Jeff, that's probably, you know, of interest to me and maybe not too many of our listeners, but I'm going to throw it out there, is when you were at Cornell, I think your thesis was on the impact of the New York dairy sector from the Tax Act of 1986. I almost said 2000, but 1986. So, you know, just briefly go over what was your conclusions, what the impact was.
Yeah, Paul, you're really digging back in history here. you know, when I went to Cornell, again, I was always interested sort of where capital markets meet agriculture. And of course, when you go to a university, you have to find for your master's, find a committee. And so I did find a group that they said, why don't you look at the tax impact? Because, you know, when I was at Farm Credit, I was amazed how aggressively some farmers were using the tax code to shelter income. And there was a lot of that in the early 80s.
Still is, Jeff. Believe me, there still is. So,
but it's not quite the way it used to be.
No, true.
For sure. But so, you know, I actually collected primary data. I worked with the Farm Credit System. They were great to work with. and we went out and we gathered that data. And the one thing that sticks out in my mind is that the IRS at that time was trying to push the concept of capitalizing pre-productive expenses. That's something we do with tree and vineyard development. You can't write them off. But they were going to do that with dairy cows. So for the first 2 years of a dairy cow, you would have to capitalize that, and then you could depreciate over the life of the cow. And that in itself would really increase the income tax of farmers. But then over a long term, it would, you know, sort of moderate, right?
Right.
As you probably are aware, or maybe no one's aware at this point, all that did not happen. And the dairy sector largely came out of there untouched. But that's the one thing that sticks out in my mind. And in all fairness, I could have gone back and dug into my thesis a little bit if I had a heads up. So
Yeah, I apologize. I didn't give you the heads up that I was going to have you discuss your thesis. And actually, you're right. They were requiring capitalization of the pre-productive costs. The dairy and the livestock industry pushed back. And in response, they sort of said, well, you don't have to do that. But instead of being able to use double declining balance on depreciable assets, you're going to have to use 150%. And then about 4 years ago, that got switched back to 200%. So from you were at Farm Credit, you were getting, I'm assuming, your master's degree at Cornell. And then where'd you end up going after that?
After that, I went to Washington. One of the great things about Cornell, it has a lot of relationships in Washington, D.C. And I worked for the Reagan administration as an ag and policy analyst in the Office of Management and Budget. And I was there for a short period of time. I don't think at least that kind of government work was a good fit for me.
Yeah.
And then I ended up at John Hancock in Boston, which is where I still reside. And around in the late 80s, for some of your listeners, they might remember, and it's still around, Farmer Mac.
Yep.
At the time, I was brought in to help John Hancock with their investment in Farmer Mac and the insurance companies. And two in particular, Prudential and John Hancock, were the two big investors in Farmer Mac. So I led that effort for 24 months or so for Hancock. And then I started to get into the agricultural equity business, or buying farms for institutional investors from that point. And originally started doing it just for the John Hancock account.
And I'm going to guess, Jeff, that most of those investments in the ag sector were more on the permanent crop side versus the row crop side. Would that be an accurate statement, or was there a pretty good mix of both, or what was the focus of at least John Hancock at that point in time?
When I started at Hancock, one thing I did is work with the foreclosed real estate portfolio. We were coming out of the farm crisis, the 80s. We had a lot of properties, and through this effort, we took a close look at the portfolio of properties that most of them were being liquidated, but we decided to keep some of the assets. We viewed them as good long-term assets. And so, over time, the portfolio at Hancock was 50-50, maybe a little heavier. We were definitely buying more permanent crops, the trees and vines. We liked the, and I still personally, in my Agus Capital, we still like the risk and return trade-off of owning permanent crops, the trees. Mm-hmm.
And I seem to be getting a little feedback on my end. Hopefully, it's okay. So yes, we know that there was some bad ag loans during that point in time. Is there any particular story you have? I mean, without mentioning names, but is there any unique one that sort of sticks out in your mind?
I would say the one thing I learned from working in a foreclosed portfolio is, you can go decades lending and take the higher risk investment and get the extra 50 basis points. And a lot of people did that for decades. But when you hit the 1980s, and anyone who studied or lived through it knew that the level of volatility we just hadn't experienced since the Great Depression. And during the 1980s, those higher risk investments or loans obviously had a much higher foreclosure rate. So, you know, it all comes down to where you are in the cycle. I will say the other thing that I experienced firsthand, if you're in Champaign, Illinois, the land values don't fall as far and they don't fall as fast. And they're so it's sort of similar to commercial real estate. You know, it's all about location, location, location.
And then you ended up starting or help start sort of an institutional market where you're going out and trying to raise funds to invest in ag, which is a big deal these days. I mean, I'm well aware of several funds, and you know, and our firm works with several funds. Go through that history a little bit.
Yeah, when you know, again, going back to, I've always found capital markets, the pinch point between capital markets and agriculture, fascinating. So in the early 90s, you know, when we were taking some of these assets back, we had a timber equity division that was doing quite well. And I made the pitch to senior management, why don't we try to do this with agriculture? And I know Metropolitan had an offering, I think it was in the late 80s. It didn't quite get off the ground. It was probably just, you know, a year or two early. But the company said, yeah, go ahead and try to do this. The only problem was I was in my late 20s. And, you know, for us to be successful, we would have to go out, or, and I was the front person, have to go out and ask institutions, and generally U.S. pension funds, for $20 million or $50 million and say, give it to us as a fiduciary, and we'll go build out a portfolio of farmland properties for you. And you can imagine being in your late 20s, early 30s, that was very difficult. We also ran into, especially in the Midwest, I would say people in on certain boards or investment committees would be have a history of touched by the farm crisis. You know, sometimes their uncle lost a farm. And I had more than one person say to me, I don't see how I can make any money in agriculture. If Uncle Bob lost his farm and couldn't be successful, I don't see how anyone can be. And that was something I heard quite a bit. But by the mid-90s, we started to raise institutional funds for investing in farmland. And early on, a lot of the emphasis was on those permanent crops, you know, the trees and vines.
And of course, I'm based right in the middle of that trees and vines, you know. You know, Walla Walla has sort of become the Napa of the North, I guess would be a way of saying it. I think we're up to, I don't know if we're hitting 200 wineries in the area, but we're pretty close. You know, we got a fair amount of vineyards here. We got orchards, we got hops and so on. So we're not quite as big as California, but I think with the weather issues that California is having and the water issues that they're having, more and more of that's going to cycle up here to the north. The Columbia River is still in pretty good shape for producing a fair amount of irrigation.
Yeah, that's an emerging area, and the town of Walla Walla is a great little town and seems to be positioning itself well around hospitality and being able to hopefully capitalize on the whole emerging wine industry in that area.
It's done a very good job of that. I mean, it's one, I can't remember, it's some fairly national magazine or newspaper said we're the wine town of the world, you know, for the last couple of years. So and now it may mean that we're paying them a lot of money to get that award. I don't know. So, you know, you never know on some of those awards. Now, it also looks like you were part of the development of the National Council of Real Estate Fiduciaries, or the NCREIF, or however it's pronounced, Farmland Index. Go through that history.
Yeah, you know, the NCREIF organization got started originally focused on commercial real estate. It's mostly made up of academics, but also people from the investment world. And so NCREIF was established for commercial real estate. I had experience, again, going back when I was a young man, there was a gentleman who was nice enough to take my call and hear the pitch. And he looked at me and he said, so if we chose to give you this money, how would we know if you were doing a good job for us? And I said, well, you know, you would know if we gave you 10, 12% returns, and you should be happy. And he goes, well, how would I know that the next farmland manager wouldn't give me 14%? So, you know, absolute, the numbers look good, but relative to the competitor, it might not be so attractive. So it came down to, we need a benchmark, you know, and the one thing that early on being going through the CFA program, I knew I was familiar with benchmarks. And if this asset class, being farmland, was going to develop, we had to have a benchmark. So we could solve the question that this older gentleman had asked, you know, how do you differentiate between absolute and relative return? So we, Hancock, and then there's two or three other groups, approached NCREIF and asked if they would sponsor the development of a NCREIF farmland index. And of course they did. It was small at the time, but it has grown to be fairly significant at this point in time.
Yeah, and I know that Bruce Sherry, who's a professor at University of Illinois there in Champaign, you had mentioned Champaign, he and I had some discussions on the index and so on a few months ago when he was actually out in our neck of the woods, and we had dinner at a local hotel/restaurant. And then it looked like you spent about close to 25 years at John Hancock, and then you decided to retire. And I'm guessing you're probably like me, although I'm not quite to retirement, but you know, retirement is probably not going to be me sitting at home. I think my wife's going to force me out. What did you do post John Hancock?
I did retire after being there 20 plus years. I thought it was time for a change. I know I have friends that are in the HR business, and they've told me if you stay at one organization for 20 years, you're a dinosaur. So I was definitely a dinosaur in their eyes. But, you know, I was ready to retire. I was fortunate enough to be in a pretty good position. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had two mentors, which I can't say enough about, that were always helping me with my career and directing me. And they both were very outspoken in saying I was too young to retire. And I said, well, you know, I just need to make a change. And so I actually did retire. I spent about 2 months down in Florida. It was in the winter months. And I sort of regrouped and figured out what I wanted to do next. And I did that, and I probably wasn't out. But first of all, I was very bored. I can't, you know, going to the beach. That wasn't very attractive to me. So I was very bored. And within, I would say, 6 months, 9 months, I had decided I wanted to start another investment firm. Because when you go through a process like retirement, you do a lot of soul searching that, at least for me, I couldn't do until I left something behind. Mm-hmm. And if I left it behind, I could say, well, what gets me out of bed? What excites me? And to me, it became clear it was the idea of building investment teams, working with clients, you know, putting portfolios together of prime farmland. And fortunately, over the years, I knew different people and had relationships, and that they'd always said, well, if you ever want to do something, let us know. So that was the beginning of Agus Capital. You know, we had access to capital and clients. And once we allowed our non-competes to fall off, Agus Capital was launched. I did that with two of my former associates at Hancock, and it was launched. And over the years, we've had a number of Hancock people that have joined us, people that I've known and worked with over the years. So that was the history and how we got started.
I think, Jeff, right now we're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsor, but we'll come back and we'll continue with what Agus is actually doing now, maybe some of the areas that you're focusing in on, and so on. But we'll go ahead and take a quick short break right now.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. And we're going to continue our conversation with Jeff Conrad from Agus Capital. You know, before the break, Jeff, we were just starting into the fact that, you know, you retired, you got a little bit bored, and it was time to go back into sort of raising capital for farmland investments. Let's dig a little bit more into what you're doing right now as far as your focus, because I think it's more than just farmland investments. I think you're doing more the supply chain of ag, but I'd be curious to get a little bit more color on that side of your operation.
Sure. When we launched Agus Capital, it's looking back, I realized I was very lucky, or we were very lucky, because we had a clean slate and we had no legacy to deal with. And, you know, with that clean slate, we brought our experience of 20 plus years. And we said, what is our investment focus going to be? And we said, based on that experience and the returns that we achieved for our clients, we said, let's start focused on permanent crops. And we did that. So we were doing the trees and vines, almonds, walnuts, pistachios, apples, cherries, blueberries, olives. And you'll see there's a very common theme. Almost all of our crops tend to be consumed by humans. And some people call them healthy crops. But, you know, the trends are very positive as far as demand growth. So we do the farmland. And as you said, we go what I call beyond the farm gate, and go down the supply chain sometimes. And we do that very selectively. So the majority of our money is still in the farmland, but we will go into further processing, such as packing sheds or simple packing sheds, or like in the olive space, we've done beyond the farm gate and processing. And in that investment, we actually went the whole way to the retail store. So,
okay.
It's a little bit of farmland and then a little operating companies is how I like to put it.
Yeah, and like you say, when you're dealing with the permanent crops, once you get past the farm gate, so to speak, most of them are associated with getting it packed, getting it distributed, getting it marketed. So that tends to be a little bit more vertically integrated than at least the row crop side. And I'm guessing that most of the funds that you've raised have been probably either pension plans or maybe some family offices. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, we almost all of our money is from pension funds. That's the sector that I had relationships and was familiar with. You know, we based on our experience, understand what motivates them, what's important to them. I'm not saying that we couldn't work with high net worth individuals, but, you know, we have a minimum investment generally of $100 million. So, you know, it takes a pretty well-off family office, yeah, a sizable family office, to give us $100 million. Even with our pension fund clients, let's say a fund might be $100 billion. You know, they might give you or choose to put in ag $500 million. So of the $100 billion, it might be less than 1% would go in.
Right.
So, you know, when we work with a client, we're just looking to get a very, very, very small allocation relative to their total portfolio.
And since you're dealing with these pension funds, and again, they might have 100 billion or 50 billion, and they're only allocating maybe, you know, 50 or, you know, half of a 1%, 50 basis points, I suppose we could use that terminology. Why are they choosing to put their money into farmland investment?
Yeah, there's a few things. And, you know, early on in my career, we used to use USDA data for our research. More recently, we've used NCREIF data. But, you know, when you look at farmland relative to stocks and bonds, venture capital, private equity, historically, it's provided a pretty attractive, what I'd say, risk-adjusted return. Because being risk-adjusted, farmland as a whole, especially if you're doing it on a portfolio basis, you know, putting a few farms together, it's a fairly low-risk investment relative to venture capital, private equity, and some of these other alternative investments that a plan sponsor would be looking for. So it would be returns. The other thing is, historically, farmland's been a great inflation hedge. We used to talk about inflation, and it does seem now in the last few months we're starting to talk about it again. But historically, farmland tends to perform well during inflationary periods. Also, farmland has a negative to sort of neutral correlation with other asset classes. So what that means, that if the stock market's going up, historically farmland is not gone up. It might be neutral or gone down. And if I'm a fund manager, I like that because I don't want all my different investments or asset classes to be moving in the same direction. So I like that diversification.
And even farming, if we look at it over the last 20 years, you know, we look at the financial crisis of 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, that period, that's actually when farming was probably the best it's been in the last 50 years, until maybe now with some pricing going up on the row crop side. I'm not talking the permanent side. So that's, go ahead, Jeff.
Very true. And I remember doing 1999 and 2000, the dot-com craze, everything was doing great on equity markets. And then we had that tank, and our portfolio was doing extremely well by 02. And, you know, so it just, history, even the data suggests it, but my experience and probably your experience just supports it.
Part of the reason why I'm buying farmland right now is because, you know, I got dirt in my blood. I'm not going to get it out. But also, I think, for me, it's going to be a very good long-term investment. Now, I have four boys. I'm not sure if any of them are interested in maintaining it after I'm gone. But, you know, I'm not too worried about it really going down in value, especially over a long-term horizon. So that's the reason why they might want to invest over on your side, as being the person that's helping them and so on. What's your biggest challenges right now just dealing with your business or dealing with those farmland investments?
You know, a lot of people will always say biggest challenge being the weather. You know, we expect to have volatile weather. So that's sort of baked into how we look at the world. You know, it's always a challenge to find good quality assets. It's always a challenge to, you know, maintain your investment team and, you know, make things exciting for the group. So I would say it's always a challenge to find good assets. You know, we all want to find that good asset and pick it up at the best price that we possibly can. Yeah. And so I would say that. And then combining that is, you know, you look at our business, it's two sides, raising the capital. When we go into the pension funds and pitch our product or, you know, to them, and, you know, we take them on tours of properties, they get to know us. So that's important as well.
I'm just curious, because I know, looking at your website and, you know, just having this discussion with you, I know most of it is based on what I call the left coast, you know, Oregon, Washington, and California. you know, as far as a mix percentage wise, you know, if, I'm just sort of curious how much is in Washington versus California versus Oregon, not dollar wise, but more of a percentage wise. What would that mix sort of look like? I mean, and I know it's not accurate, but sort of a range.
Yeah, most permanent crop portfolios and will be very heavy in California. I don't have the NCREIF numbers in front of me, but I always say that's a good way to look at it. And I think it might be 70 to 80% of NCREIF permanent crops is in California. So you have California, Washington is the next behind California, but a big gap between the two. You know, Oregon, you know, you can do, we've done stuff in Georgia, we've done stuff in Michigan. There are other states. If you're some of the nut crops, you can go down to southern U.S. If you want to do something, or peaches in Georgia. So, I mean, there are other areas, but you're right. It's as you would have guessed. And if you study the ag sector, you'll see that California dominates the numbers, and especially in permanent crops. And so you would expect institutional portfolio to mirror that.
Yeah. And we just know with climate change, and I don't care who causes climate change, we know there is climate change. I mean, we just went through, you know, a little bit of that in the last few days here with record temperatures. You know, those pockets of permanent crops, I think over the next 10 or 20 or 30 years, if climate change continues the way it's continuing, you're going to see it moving likely either farther north, or it's going to be moving. You know, they're not going to be able to maintain those plantings that they've had for the last 100 years in California. So we'll see what happens. It'll be very, very interesting.
Yeah, no, it's a challenge, and people are pushing new varieties. They're more tolerant, more drought tolerant, and you're right. You could see migration of those important centers migrating more north.
And then let's just, before we end here, there are some common myths when you're talking about institutions buying in farmland or buying up farmland and so on. Why don't you go through maybe what a couple of those myths might be and why they really are a myth?
Yeah. You know, one of the ones I hear a lot, and you'll even see this in the mainstream press, they'll talk about corporations are taking over U.S. agriculture, and people generally throw us into that mix. And, you know, even if you do take it at the broadest number being corporations and accept that, most of those are family farms. They might be multi-generational. And I always tell our clients, or if I'm having a discussion with my friends, it's not the idea of the family farm that you might be thinking of 20, 30 years ago. It could be a family farm with a $100 million balance sheet.
Yeah.
So a lot of them are still family farms. And then you do have institutions that get thrown into that corporate farm group. But, you know, when you look at the amount of land that the institutions such as Agus Capital hold, I mean, it's a small, small, small fraction of any total numbers. So it's probably less than 1%.
Yeah, it's... And that's something, and I think I've mentioned on this podcast before, what irks me at times is, you know, I'll see some media, you know, article or whatever, and it'll refer to corporate farming taking over the farmland and so on. And like you say, most of those corporate farms are multi-generational family farms that just happen to be, you know, set up as a corporation. They're really just still a family. They just happen to have that structure. And the reality is, like you said earlier in our podcast, you grew up on a dairy farm with 40 cows. You could not make a living with 40 cows on a dairy farm right now. It might even be tough to make a living with 400 dairy cows. So, you know, ag will continue to consolidate. That's just what happens with a capital intensive business like ours.
Yeah. And I always tell people when I'm working with them, think about your local hardware store. Think about your local pharmacy. These industries have consolidated, and you know, agriculture is doing the same thing.
Yeah. Well, this has been very, very interesting, Jeff. I guess I you know, typically, and I forgot to sort of warn you on this, but maybe I'll throw it out to you. What I try to end these conversations with, I sort of ask, what keeps you up at night? And then I also ask, what do you deem success in farming or success in a business is? So first, is there anything that keeps you up at night, or the fact that you've retired and you've accumulated some wealth and you're sitting there enjoying yourself, or what keeps you up at night?
People would always ask that, and they would assume it would be the weather. And I said, if you do this long enough, you expect the crazy weather and the impact. One of the things that we've experienced over the last few years, and what I would always worry about, because some of our crops are highly exported, and is trade wars.
Yeah.
And we if you look at the tariffs on some of our nut properties that got put in place the last few years, we're still struggling from those. So that's something I worry about. As far as, what I deem success, and what gets me out of bed, I think success for me, and I think for Agus Capital, is to have clients that are very happy. We've done a good job for them. At the end of the day, they're just trying to make money to pay their pensioners, so their retirees that might have been working at a state job or a school teacher. So to me, and success at Agus Capital is to make them happy and provide the kind of returns they expect. And I think secondary and almost as important, but clients are first, is the team that we assemble, that they feel challenged, happy to come to work, and feel they're part of something beyond themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good points on that. Well, Jeff, I think, like I say, I typically, we try to keep these at about 30 to 45 minutes. I think we're definitely in that range. And I thank you very much for being on the podcast today. Is there anything else you'd like to tell our audience?
No, I think, thank you for the opportunity, Paul. I really appreciate it. And it's been fun.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I'm Paul Niefer, and we'll be back next week with a new episode of the Farm CPA podcast with Top Producer.